Stanley Koren of the Department of Psychology at UBC. I noticed that Professor Koren's brief resume runs to 15 closely typed pages, so I won't read it all, but I'll remind you that his undergraduate work was done at the University of Pennsylvania, and that he obtained his doctorate at Stanford University. He's an editorial consultant to some 12 professional journals and has published over 100 articles. Professor Koren's principal concern is with problems of sensation, perception, vision, and visual illusion, subjects which have important implications not only in psychology and physiology, but for philosophy and the theory of knowledge as well. He has co-authored a book called Sensation and Perception, and a leading text entitled Seeing is Deceiving, The Psychology of Visual Illusions, which is also the title of his talk this evening. Professor Stanley Koren.
Let me ask you just a couple of quick questions. How do you know what color the sky is? Or how do you know that I'm waving my right hand? Now, you might think that such questions are trivial because you have the data from your senses. Your brain interprets the visual input from your eyes and says, blue sky, or hand waves. Now, we ascribe a great deal of faith to the data of our senses. We assume that what we see always corresponds to reality. Now, why not? You're probably thinking to yourself that this is just another academic discourse trying to make something simple seem complex. I see my hand in front of me because it's there. I see you in front of me because you're there, and so forth. Now, this is the universal belief of our species. It's encoded in a whole bunch of sort of very traditional proverbs. We say things like, seeing is believing. Or the Missouri farmer who doesn't believe what you've just told him says, show me. In other words, give me the evidence for my senses. Even long before the birth of Christ, the philosopher Lucretius asked, what can give us surer knowledge than our senses? With what else can we distinguish the true from the false? Now, this type of belief is incredibly adaptive. To believe in the data from our senses is very important. It keeps us alive. For example, could you imagine how long you would survive in Vancouver if, as you crossed a street and you saw the image of a car apparently hurtling toward you, you now had to stop and ponder to yourself and say, is that a car going toward me, or is this merely based upon the data from my senses? And by that time, you have tire tracks running up and down your chest. Instead, you believe the data from your senses, and you jump out of the way and you stay alive. Now, some philosophers, such as Immanuel Kant, ascribe to perception an immediate, almost godlike knowledge of the external reality. Unfortunately, all of this faith, all of this philosophy, and all of this folklore is misplaced. Percepts are often wrong, and seeing is often deceiving. For instance, in this particular slide, if I can untangle this, in this particular slide, there are two vertical lines, a line labeled A and a line labeled B. The line labeled B appears to be longer than the line labeled A, despite the fact that the two lines are physically identical in length. Oops. In this particular slide, we see a set of circles. What I want you to do is pay attention to this circle and that circle. Those two circles are identical in size, physically identical in size, although this one appears to be considerably smaller than that one. In some respects, this is Howard Cosell surrounded by basketball players or by racehorse jockeys. Now, in some cases, the distortions can be really quite large. For example, if you take a look at this line marked AX and compare it to line marked AY, yes, again, the litany, it is in fact the case that these two lines are identical in size. Now, if I had you reproduce a line the length of AX and another one the length of AY, you would set the difference, you would set this line as being some 35% longer than the other. Now, direction as well as size can also appear distorted. For example, these four lines over here are all absolutely vertical and absolutely parallel. Despite the fact that this appears to be wider at the top and pinched in at the bottom, they are all absolutely vertical and absolutely parallel. Directions or distortions of direction can show up in a variety of different ways. They can alter shape. For example, here we again have two parallel lines. They are absolutely straight and absolutely parallel. This bulge or bending outward, which you see, does not physically exist. It exists only in your eye. If you don't like bulges outward, we can use the same principle. Oops, we can't use the same principle, don't we? We can use the same principle to bend those lines inward. Again, that inward bend does not exist. Those two lines are absolutely horizontal, parallel, and straight. Now, even in the simplest displays, we can get distortions. For example, in this figure, we have only two lines. We have a vertical line marked A and a horizontal line marked B. Those two lines, again, are absolutely identical in size, despite the fact that the line marked A appears to be considerably longer than the line marked B. Now, this type of distortion occurs in a number of real-life objects. For example, in this schematic top hat, the height of the hat is identical to the width of the hat. By the way, this is the same principle which accounts for the fact that a tree appears to be so tall when it is standing and much less impressive once it's felled. Now, in fact, in one instance, we were very lucky. The architect Saarinen provided us with the largest real-life example of this distortion that I've ever seen. This is the Gateway Arch, which is located in St. Louis. It is 630 feet from this end of the base to that end of the base, and it is 630 feet from there to the top. That photo was taken at great risk of my falling off into the water from an angle where, in fact, it is this distance is equal on the slide to this distance. So what you're seeing over there is the same distortion. It appears to be massively taller than it is wide. Now, sometimes these effects can really be quite spectacular and really tax your belief in whether or not I'm telling you the truth. You know, I've been going ahead and stretching the slides off on the side. For example, consider this figure. What do you see? Well, I think most of you would see a set of spirals, sort of twisted blue spirals, moving inward toward the center, like this. Right? Okay? Now, in fact, there is no spiral there. The entire figure is made up of a set of concentric circles. These are my hand-drawn concentric circles, like this. That is to say, there are no spirals going inward. And if you don't believe it, then what I'll do is I'll superimpose that set of circles on the figure itself. And you can see that they absolutely cover up some lines. Now, you have to be very careful. For example, over here, they're close together, and you can see that there is no spiral, which swishes inward. Over here, in the middle, where we haven't corrected for it, you're still going to get the same illusory distortion. A very funny thing about this particular illusion is that sometimes when I have students trace it out for themselves, the illusion is so strong that it pulls their hand off of the circle as they attempt to trace it out. Now, whilst in these instances, some of these distortions are rather amusing, in some cases, the results of distortions can be really quite disastrous. For instance, let's consider this particular distortion. In this case over here, you can see we have two lines down over here and two lines over here. Now, what I want you to do is to imagine extending this line. You probably see it as if it's going to pass under this one, and this one appears as though it's going to pass under this one, right? If you simply extended them. In actuality, they are physically collinear. That is to say, they're straight lines. So here I've simply laid a ruler running along it. Notice the bottom one still appears to be distorted, right? It still looks as though it's going to run under because we haven't laid the ruler across it. This particular distortion actually resulted in a tragedy occurring in the airspace over New Jersey a couple of years ago. A flight controller was looking at a radar screen which looked rather like this. These lines over here represent air control space and flight paths. This line, which actually on the radar screen was a little bit blurrier than it is here, is the oncoming flight path of a plane leaving the Kennedy Airport Control District. And this is the flight path of one which is coming in toward the Kennedy Airport Control District. And in fact, the air controller glanced at these two tracks, and it was quite clear to him that they were going to pass many feet apart of one another. In actuality, those two streaks are directly on collision line. The two planes veered very sharply. The Boeing managed to get away. The Lockheed happened to turn so tightly that the plane lost control and crashed in a New Jersey field and killed four people and ended up destroying a $10 million airplane. So sometimes these same distortions, which we can reproduce with lines on paper or lines in a screen, can cause very drastic consequences. Now you might ask yourself, why do such errors or illusions occur? Now in order to understand this, we must first know something about how our conscious experience comes about. Now the ease with which we use our eyes, apparently simply by opening our lids, masks the fact that perception is an extremely complicated activity, not of the eyes, but of the brain. It calls upon subtle classifications, comparisons, and decisions well beyond the early events associated with the light stimulating the eye. 450 years before Christ, Epicharmus summed up this fact when he said, "The mind sees and the mind hears, the rest is blind and deaf." Now the mind, in fact, which is doing all of this perceiving, has no need of physical reality or of geometrical law. It follows its own, call them non-physical or mental laws. For example, let's consider the following situation. In this situation, we have a set of six arrowheads. Now, what I want you to do is to simply judge the relative distance between here and here and compare it to the distance between here and here. Okay? And as you can see, this distance appears to be longer than that distance. In fact, if we could schematically represent the relative distances, they would look like this. The upper line seems a little space seems a little bit longer, the middle one a little bit shorter, the bottom one a little bit longer. Okay, now I want you to look at this stimulus in a different way. I simply want you to look at where this point is relative to that point. If you look at where this point is relative to that point seems to be too much in that direction, and this one in that direction. In fact, if you simply judge the location of the points of the at the ends of those angles, you would get a situation which looks like this. Okay, this one out, that one, pardon, this one out, that one in, and so forth. Now notice something. In geometry, in real space, the distance between two objects is set by the endpoints. The endpoints tell us that these two are closer, and these two are, then this is farther. Hence, this line is longer than that. But when you judge the distance instead of judging the location, you end up with the judgment that the upper line is longer and the middle one is shorter, and so forth. Unfortunately, brains don't know much about geometry. So, you're probably muttering to yourself by now, so we make errors, right? Okay, and God knows that sometimes we're irrational. The real point is that our senses simply carry a picture of the outside world to our brain, and that's it. Now, that's way too simple an answer. I mean, if you see a car, do you believe that somewhere inside your brain there's a little picture of a car? And if you see the traffic light turn green, do you believe that a little piece of your brain turns green? And if such were the case, would it help you to see? Certainly, such images inside the brain are only of value if there are eyes inside the head to see those images inside the brain. And then we'd have to ask, well, how do those eyes inside the head see? Well, of course, they're carrying pictures to their brain, and we're going to end up with an endless sequence of pictures and eyes and pictures and eyes. And the ultimate question as, or the ultimate problem as to who is perceiving and how would still remain unanswered. Now, perhaps one aspect of how we go about and form these mental images and how we our mental images and our picture of the world is sometimes wrong can be illustrated by considering the following situation, which happened to me a couple of years ago. One night, as I was sort of staggering out of bed, feeling quite thirsty, I decided I was going to walk into the kitchen and get myself a glass of water. I didn't want to turn on the lights and wake up anybody else in the house, so I sort of padded across the living room, and there in the center of the floor, I saw my dog. I had this marvelously little dumb Cairn Terrier. And he looked so cute, just sort of flumped up in the middle of the floor, that I bent over to pat him. All of a sudden, I felt very stupid, because there I was patting my footstool. So I backed up to really feeling dumb and banged my foot up against the edge of this marble-topped coffee table which we had. And I reached back to steady myself only to find that my hand was now resting on the head of my dog. His cold nose was up against the back of my foot. Now, in this particular case, if I had not reached down and touched the footstool, I would have sworn in a court of law that I had seen a dog. And if I had not reached back and touched the dog's head, I would have sworn that I had banged up against the table. In each case, the percept was really quite clear. The purpose of this particular example is not to point out that I am really very stupid in the dark, but rather is to point out the fact that in many ways there is a very fine line between perceiving an object and guessing an object. Pardon. Consider for a moment this object. So everybody now says, aha, so now he gets a chance to show the picture of his dog, right? Right, he's causing all the trouble. So you go ahead and you see a picture of what? It's a dog. Now, tell me for a moment, if you saw a dog like this, all right, walking down the street, you would have a fit, right? Okay, he's missing all this portion of his body. Yet you see a dog. Do you see a dog or conclude that a dog is there? Well, you say you see it. Again, in this particular case, you have the hypothesis that there is a dog, and hence you seem to be perceiving a dog. Some instances are a little bit more difficult. For example, what do you see here? Oh, somebody's seeing something which I didn't intend. Oh, see, now this one's rougher, huh? The reason this one is rougher is because the hypothesis is much further from your everyday experience than what you normally see. Dogs are common. Here, we'll give you a hint as to what you see. You see it? It's sort of a Prince Valiant type character riding a horse. Okay, now when you look back, oops, where are we? Now when you look back over here, you see this man riding a horse. Do you actually see it? Do you guess it? Do you hypothesize it? What? Okay. Once the hypothesis is there, there's a very unfortunate aspect. And that is, now you will always see that as a horse and rider. And it's very, very difficult to see it the way or to even recall fully the way that you first saw it when you didn't know what it was. Now, where do such, call them for the moment, perceptual hypotheses come from? Now, to answer this, we're going to run a little experiment. Now, since we are all scientists over here, and so we're going to turn this into a controlled laboratory, we are going to designate you with appropriate names. Everybody on this side of the line is going to be called Group A. You see, this is science, right? And everybody on this side of the line is going to be called Group B. Now, in order to run this demonstration, we need some cooperation from you, okay? What I'm going to do is, first of all, I am going to show a series of slides of figures to the Group A side. And all I want you to do is to call out what you see. Please do not criticize the artwork. I'm a psychologist, I'm not an artist. Group B, and this is very important if the demonstration is to work. Everybody in Group B has to close their eyes. Keep your eyes absolutely closed. Okay? Otherwise, the demonstration is not going to work. Okay? Group B, eyes closed. Oh, we have people cheating in Group B. Eyes closed. Close, close, close. All Group B's, eyes closed. Okay, Group A, all I want you to do now is to call out what you see. Okay, ready? Oops. Oops, that was not supposed to be. There we go. Ready? Here we go, Group A. Terrific, okay. A little louder.
One.
Great.
One.
Okay.
Nine.
Okay.
Teacher.
Okay. Okay, that's my mother too, yes. Okay. Okay, now. Group B, open your eyes. Group A, you don't have to shut your eyes. Now you just have to simply shut your mouth. Okay? Okay? Group B, I'm going to show you a series of pictures. What I would like you to do is I'd like you to simply tell me what you see. Loud, okay? These guys don't talk very loud on this side of the room. Okay? Here we go.
Fish.
Okay.
Fish.
What is that group A? Group A, tell me what that is. It's an old man. Let's go back over here and show Group B the old man, okay? Whoops. Nope, that's not the old man. So, here we go. That's the old man. For those of you in Group B who can't find an old man in there to save your lives, here's his glasses, here's his big nose, his sort of shaggy chin and his ear. For those of you in Group A who can't find the rat anywhere in over there, or the mouse, there is big ears over here. Here's his nose, his front paw, his back paw, and his tail. Tell me, is it a man or is it a mouse? Now, in this particular experiment, we set up a set of expectations which resulted in you seeing, in one half of the room, seeing something which was quite different from what the other half of the room was seeing. In the one case, we set up an expectation or a hypothesis that you were going to be seeing faces. In the other case, we set up an expectation or the hypothesis that you were going to be seeing animals. And in both cases, you saw what your hypothesis was. Now, some hypotheses don't have to be very precise, and they don't have to take very long in order to form. For example, what do you see here? Vases, or some people see them as sort of crummy pictures of white owls and that sort of thing. Now watch this for a moment, because we're going to change the way you see that for the rest of your lives. Right? Will it ever look the same again? Now suddenly, contours which had before no particular meaning have a new meaning and are viewed in a different way. Now, some hypotheses take a lifetime to learn. In the next slide, I'm going to show you a set of black figures, which I want you to consider. Okay, you see the black figures, right? Can you see the word?
Yeah.
Fly. Fly is the word, okay? Do you now see it? F-L-Y. It's the space between the figures. Now, for those of you who didn't see the word at first but saw the black figures, once the word is there, it's really very hard to see those black figures as being separate again. This has to do with your knowledge of our particular alphabet and the meaningfulness of that word. Also notice something, by the way. Some of you will probably now notice that there's sort of a faint line running along over here and over there. That faint line doesn't exist. You're now adding that in order to complete the letters. We'll show you how quickly and how much you can add. For example, what do you see there? Feet, okay? Now actually, the word feet consists of 10 bent lines, okay? 10 bent black lines. All this white stuff, like this line over here which you see, and that line, and this line, and that line over there, doesn't exist. If we ran a photometer across here, it would say that all of this is uniform white. The only places which are not uniform white and of exactly the same photometric qualities are the black lines. You supply those figures. Now tell me, if you were unilingual Japanese, would you see that? And if you said, hey, look, there's a word in there. Hey, look, look, do you see this line over here? Look, this one right over there, which is would you expect them to see the top cross line on the E? No, because they don't have the hypothesis for it. Now, other hypotheses, or call them guessing strategies if you like, arise from how we view the world and how we represent the world. Clearly, when we look around the world, We see a three-dimensional universe. Objects are arranged in space, some objects are close to us, some objects are far from us. Now this is actually an incredible feat. It's an incredible mental feat because of the following problem. Functionally, the image which you are dealing with, the real stimulus for vision, is a flat image inside the eye. It has no tridimensionality. What's worse is the largest that that image can be is about a centimeter from top to bottom. Yet when you look at me, you say, hey, look, he's about 5'10", or you look at that screen, you say that screen is about 15, 20 feet running across, or whatever else. Now, how can you see these things as having that particular size when you're dealing with this tiny, tiny little image inside the eye? And that's all that you're dealing with. Now, this has been quite a problem for a number of years. I mean, my favorite theory of vision was offered by Protagoras a number of years ago, well before Christ. And his notion was, hey, look, certainly it's the case that you can't see a whole object because all those light rays can't get into that tiny little hole, which is the pupil of your eye. So what he said is, but I can figure out how large a table is by simply palpating it, simply touching it. So it's not that the rays go from the object to the eye, but rather the rays go out of the eye to the object. You sort of palpate it like this. It's a marvelously sensual theory of vision. You know, now when I walk across campus and see somebody I like, I go palp, 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 palp. Unfortunately, optics tells us that, in fact, we're dealing with an image inside the eye. Now, this image has a definite, has a tiny size, and not only does it have a tiny size, but it has a variable size. For example, as an image grows closer to us or further away from us, it changes in size. Images which are close to, or objects which are close to us, like this line A, cast larger images, and objects which are farther away cast smaller sized images. Now, normally that doesn't bother us at all. For example, if we look at this woman, at these two pictures over there, we say, hey, yeah, that's the same woman, and yeah, whatever she was here, 5 foot tall here, she's 5 feet tall there. Now notice, over here, she's considerably smaller. Yet we correct her size on the basis of her perceived distance. So even though her image is varying inside of our eye, on the basis of our hypothesis that images change as a function of their distance from us, we ascribe an appropriate size. For that reason, we look at these telephone poles and we say, yeah, they're all the same size, they're just varying in distance. All of these railroad ties are the same size, they're just varying in distance. In other words, we are expanding, if you will, the size of distant objects to their appropriate size, or if you will, shrinking the size of near objects to their appropriate size. Now you say to yourself, yeah, look, but you know, that woman does look somewhat smaller than that woman. I mean, yeah, it's the same woman, but now that you've alerted me to it, you know, they look pretty much the same. Well, actually, we can give you an idea as to how much of a correction you have by considering this slide. Notice over here we have two men approximately the same size, sitting at different distances in a hallway. Now you say, yeah, look, I can see this person as being about the same size as this person, but his image is smaller anyway. Okay, now what I'm going to do is the following. This is made up by having two cutout figures. So I can now take this figure and move it down to here, which we do over here. Okay, now that we've moved them to the same apparent distance, you can see how huge your correction was. So even knowing didn't help. Now, There's another example. I mean, one can, the examples abound. I mean, here's a painting which was taken directly from a prize-winning BC vacation photograph. Over here you see a guy who's standing over there next to his monster salmon caught off the coast. Watch the salmon shrink. Notice, the size of that particular salmon depended upon your perception of the relative distance of this object. And the brain, not the eye, the brain corrects for that particular distance. Now, this corrective procedure is generally quite adaptive. And it's very, very important because we deal with objects on the basis of our presumption of what their physical size is. And an object's physical size should not be changing as objects are further away from us or closer to us. And so we correct objects, we render their size constant regardless of their distance. However, sometimes this corrective procedure can get us in tremendous trouble, especially when we are treating flat stimuli as if they were three-dimensional stimuli. Under those circumstances, we will sometimes inappropriately correct stimuli and end up with a series of distortions or illusions. For example, in this particular configuration, you can see we have two circles, and the upper circle appears to be larger than the lower circle. They are actually identical in size. Now, this illusion comes about because you are treating this as though it's some sort of picture. It's some sort of picture based upon some depth information or a depth cue. Normally, converging lines tend to represent distances or changes in distance. So this represents a railroad track receding off into the distance. Notice that if it really is a three-dimensional scene, then we expect the more distant objects of the same physical size to appear to be smaller. If this represents, or is treated by the brain, if you will, as a three-dimensional figure, inappropriately, because of these converging lines, then this corresponds to that distance back there, that's seen as further away, than this. Now, how could they both have the same size retinal image, same size image inside your eye, if there are different distances? That could only come about if this object were physically larger, therefore you correct the percept, and overestimate the size of that upper figure. We can make the illusion really quite strong by actually superimposing stimuli on an actual picture. So these two red bars are identical in size. Notice over here that this one appears to be much larger. The reason that it appears to be much larger is they're casting the same size image, but this one is seen as being further away. Now, as far as the mind is concerned, there is a very fine line between an illusion and a picture. For example, here we have three cylinders, all of which are identical in size. All are identical in size. Yet this one appears to be much larger than that one. Is that an illusion? Well, it's an illusion in the sense that if you are estimating the size of this figure relative to that figure, you're certainly overestimating this one relative to that one. But if that was a picture of three canisters in some hallway, how could that picture come about? That could only come about if this was the smallest one, that was the next size, and that was the largest. Now, many illusions can be explained by the inappropriate application of the correction factor of correcting for distance. For example, In this case, we see this line as being longer than that line. Okay? Now, this comes around from exactly the same, or the operation of exactly the same procedure. This configuration is very similar to viewing the outside corner of a building. And this configuration is very similar to viewing the inside corner of our nice rectangular carpentered world. Now notice, in this case, the shaft is closer to you than the wingtips. In this case, the shaft is farther away from you than the wingtips. And I think you can carry it on from there, okay? If this is seen as sort of a crude drawing of that, and this is seen as a crude drawing of that, but these two cast the same size retinal image, that can only come about since this one is farther away than that one, and so forth. Now, of course, if you lived in a primitive culture where there was no nice, regular expectation that rooms would be rectangular, that floors would be squared off and ceilings parallel, then you would not develop so strongly the hypothesis that this represents that and this represents that. In fact, in the mid-50s, before civilization had truly encroached, a group of psychologists measured that illusion in a band of rural Zulus. The Zulus live in a predominantly round culture. An anthropologist once explained this to me by saying, the reason that their culture is predominantly round is because the Zulu know that devils and demons hide in corners. So the way you get rid of the devils and demons is you don't provide any corners. You have nice round huts, and in fact, even the art is round. And you would expect, since they would not build up this hypothesis, they're not living in our carpenter three-dimensional world, that the illusion would be much less. And it is, in fact, much less. Now, it's important to note that even the assumption that there is three-dimensionality in a picture is only an assumption. For example, if I show you a figure which looks like this and I say to you, hey, look, which animal is the man about to spear? You would say what? He's going to spear the antelope. If I ask a South African bushman who has not had a lifetime history growing up with glossy photos in McLean's or flat images on the tube, he will say he is going to spear the small elephant. And in fact, if you look, that spear point is much closer to the elephant, you see? Now, the reason you don't see it as being much closer to the elephant is because you see this picture as containing depth or distance. And on the basis of that, you say, hey, this elephant is way far away. This particular antelope is up close. And your hypothesis gives both depth and distance to the targets. Now, of course, once you've set yourself up with a hypothesis that two-dimensional representations can represent three-dimensional reality, you can get yourself in a lot of trouble. I had a friend who decided to take up jogging because, you know, he knew it was good for his health and all this sort of other business. And so he started reading all of the relevant articles in medical journals, such as Playboy, on jogging. And he read in one of these trenchant articles that jogging up steps is really very good for you cardiovascularly. But jogging downstairs is terrible because your foot hits in the wrong way and everything. Now, he knew that this presented an immediate problem because, you know, if you jog upstairs, then you've got the down flight of stairs to face. So what he did is he sat down and he tried to devise an object or a device which would allow him to jog upstairs without any problems. And what he came up with was this. You see, you jump on it over here and you start jogging up the stairs and you continue jogging up the stairs and you continue jogging up the stairs like this, and when you get tired, you jump off. Now, he looked at this and he knew very well that he could now build one of these things, and he sat down with his kids' Lego blocks. And to the best of my knowledge, he's still working on it. Because although you can draw this and you can convince yourself that this thing exists in real space, it can never exist. It has to do, it's a violation of physical law. But it plays into our assumptions. Now, sometimes our assumptions can really be quite disquieting. For example, consider this stimulus. Now, stare at it for a while. Okay, now what's happening? Most of you will start to get this sort of feeling in your gut, which is bleh. Okay, now that feeling in your gut, which goes bleh, is not the fact that your eyes can't see this, but the fact that your brain is wrestling with an impossible problem. That figure cannot exist. This is called, by the way, the devil's tuning fork. And as most devils, you see, they escaped from the Zulu, because we have all these corners. The reason that it's called the devil's tuning fork is because, as in many cases, the devil has given us a paradox, which is irresolvable. One half of the figure looks like this, which is a nice, reasonable object which can exist in real space. The other half of the figure looks like this, which is a nice, reasonable object which can exist in real space, only they can't coexist in real space. Now, it's interesting. If we had showed you this particular figure without giving you the clues as to how it was constructed and then asked you to draw it, everybody in this room would have had a lot of trouble. By the way, that South African bushman, you know, the one who was stabbing the little elephant, right? Okay, he has no trouble with this because he doesn't have the presumptions that this represents three-dimensional objects. To him, it's just a pile of lines on a piece of paper, and he reproduces it quite accurately. Now, assumptions, often wrong, have not only bedeviled us, but have also bedeviled scientists throughout history, because their assumptions have actually altered what it was which they saw and what it was which they reported. Thus, Galileo, in the 1600s, when viewing the planet Saturn, had no idea that any such thing as a planet with a ring around it, which wasn't attached, could exist. So what he saw in astronomer Huygens, or however one pronounces it, who also did not have the presumption of a ring as yet. Now, both of them noticed, however, that strange things would happen. Sometimes the two attendants would disappear. And sometimes there would be great flares which would appear to be arcing off of the surface of the planet. Clearly, the old gentleman was unhappy about his attendants disappearing. Like that. Now, again, this cannot exist astronomically, and that cannot exist astronomically. Huygens eventually solved the problem by forming the appropriate hypothesis, which was that you are viewing a planet with a ring around it, which is seen in different aspects. So, for example, here is the old man with his two attendants. And here is perhaps where the arcs are coming off of the planet. And here is where all that stuff disappears. It makes sense if you have the hypothesis of a ring. It does not make sense if you don't. A similar thing happened when viewing one of the first spiral nebulae, M51, to be reported. The astronomer Hershey had no idea that you could get a galaxy in sort of a spiral shape. The idea had never occurred to him. So when he viewed this planet, or this galaxy, he reported it as being a set of sort of spherical objects with sort of a concentric halo. Guys, he had already figured out about Saturn, right? So that he knew that rings could exist. Only 17 years later, the astronomer Ross had formed the notion that, in fact, such spiral galaxies could exist, and in fact was firmly committed to the fact that almost all such galaxies were spiral in nature. And so he drew, looking at the same exact celestial object, that. Now, the actual galaxy itself looks like this. It's somewhere in between. Okay, it's not as spiraled as Ross reported, and it's not as round as Hershey reported it. However, you can say to yourself, hey, look, these guys were biased by their hypotheses. You know, they were lying, another case of fraud in science. Just remember, man or mouse. They are both entering this particular situation with a set of hypotheses. And in fact, their perception is going to be altered by that set of hypotheses. Now, up to now, we have only dealt with illusions which are common to normal people. This is people who are functioning within the normal range of assumptions. I know that each of us responds well beyond the normal range of assumptions. Now, one might expect that if we are dealing with an abnormal brain or a person who is suffering from an abnormal set of assumptions or a breakdown in the normal set of assumptions, that this person would in fact have hypotheses which might cause his percepts to differ quite a bit from our own. You might say that we are moving from the realm of illusion to the realm of delusion or hallucination. Now, we actually have an opportunity to view the course of the change in perception in one individual. That individual was an artist by the name of Wayne, who existed early or in the first quarter of this century, and he drew pictures for kids' books. Mostly he drew cats, these sort of beautiful kind of fluffy cats, and they were always beautiful. He loved cats, he really loved them. Later on in his life, Wayne began to show the acute onset of schizophrenia. However, by that time he was quite wealthy, so he was able to go to a sanitarium and bring all of his artist supplies and all of his cats. So throughout his breakdown, he continued to paint his cats as he saw them. Now, the first sign that we have of something going awry is here. You begin to notice the cat has changed somewhat. He looks considerably more wide-eyed and is now beginning to show sort of like static electricity, sort of breaking up his fur. Next, we begin to notice massive distortions beginning to set in. This cat seems to be surrounded by shimmering radio waves or electricity. This is one of the most common reports which one finds in pathological or the perception of people suffering from psychopathology. Usually at this point, this is the point where the person no longer is going to be allowed to handle any sort of art material. So usually here's where the record stops. However, in Wayne's case, it doesn't stop here. Wayne's cats began to become more and more articulated, if you will, and they began to take on combination forms so that sometimes he would report that not only were they articulated, but there were licks of flame lashing out around the sides of the cats, and they began to appear somewhat more ominous. And the deterioration became more and more spectacular. And just before he died, he gave us that one. Do you see the cat? Now, for those of you who don't, there's a cat in there, okay, at least at some level of assumption. You can probably see the cat if you do the following. For those of you who are lucky enough to wear glasses, take your glasses off and look at the blur. For those of you who are not lucky enough, squish your eyes down to blur it, and you will begin to see the faint outline of a cat. Ears, Eyes, jowls, nose, coming in over there. The assumption of a cat still exists at some level, even there. Okay, now we've come a long way. I hope that what I've been able to illustrate to you is that, in fact, when you see an object, a lot of what you're seeing is your best bet hypothesis. A lot of what you are seeing is based upon your experience and your assumptions and your education as to whether you are seeing mice or men. If you will, the trip from the eye to the mind is a long one with many turns and many opportunities to get lost. Thank you.
Professor Corin has agreed to answer questions. Please speak clearly and keep your question short. And I would ask Professor Corin to repeat the gist of the question for the benefit of those that can't hear. Yes, sir.
Is the logical assumption that some modern art we're seeing today, we're seeing something different than what the painter is putting down?
Well, that's what the painter would tell us. And in a situation like that, I would simply nod my head and sort of go along.
Yes, sir.
Is the cat sequence published anywhere?
Yes, it's published several places. There's a lovely compendium of art and psychopathology, which appeared about 12 years ago, something like that. Lynn is nodding. Yes, yes, sir. You will usually find it either under art or under psychopathology, depending upon which librarian laid their hands on the book last. Wayne, W-A-I-N.
Yes, gentleman in the back.
The slide that you showed of the hunter, the antelope, and the elephant from a South African hunter's experience, would he not judge that the elephant was far too distant to be hit with the spear?
No, he will actually say that's a tiny elephant. I mean, you know, the elephant is smaller. Actually, you can get more direct tests of this. Let me show you for the moment. There's no such thing as a psychologist without another slide, right? If you give these particular individuals an object or a picture which looks like this, and then you give them some sticks and some clay and you say, could you construct that? For a Westerner, they will tend to construct a three-dimensional object which looks like this. For the South African Bushman, he will in fact construct a flat object which looks like that.
Yes, sir.
Escher, Mark Escher, was a man also for the interest. Has anybody ever done a study to decide at what point he started going wrong?
I think that Escher went mad for economic and ego reasons rather than perceptual reasons. No, I don't know that anybody has ever done that. There are now two very serious studies which have come out recently, that's within the past 6 years, on the art of Escher, talking about the mechanics of it. I don't remember them talking about the psychology of the man.
Gentleman there.
Yes, when we see objects, the eye turns it around. In fact, it is upside down. Why do we bother to turn it upside down again just because we have taught that gravity goes this way?
I've asked God that question many times and he hasn't answered. I don't know. I don't know.
the gentleman here.
Oh, that has to do with another effect. You see, what I dealt with here is I dealt with one type or one source from which visual distortions can arise. There are a number of different levels at which it can arise. Some of them have to do with the way in which the light is scattered around inside the eye and the optics of the situation and some of the neural parts of the situation. That comes off of something called the irradiation illusion. It has to do with the relative contrast of the individual, and it would be a little bit difficult to explain that at this point.
The lady up there.
I'm just reading the bone of the National Thinking now, and I have looked at, here's a picture of a vase and a young woman's face.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried, you know, alternating the appearance of that, and I was thinking how, wondering how that relates to the bone of
it doesn't, but let me give you another example, okay? Right? Here. So, right, it deals with a question over here, but let's see if we can go. Okay. The story behind this goes as follows. I had a friend who lived in an apartment, and he always wanted a nice furry animal, so he got himself a rabbit. You see, which looks like this, nice little rabbit. His landlord would not allow him to have any rabbits. He claimed that you could only have, you know, you could have caged animals like birds. So every time the landlord would come, he would say, it's not a rabbit, it's a duck. You see, here's his bill in there. Now, I want you to look at that for the moment, okay? Now, notice that you can possibly see the, you know, you can, some people have a better time doing it than others. But when you see the rabbit, that's the rabbit facing in this direction, these are his ears and that's his eye, you can't see the duck. Okay, you can remember what the duck looked like, but you can't see it. When you can see the duck, okay, you can't see the rabbit. So here's the duck's bills and here's his eyes. Again, you can remember what the... Now, in this case, you are essentially seeing or essentially being displayed in consciousness is your percept, your perceptual hypothesis is what it is, as to what it is. This differs from the sort of thing like holding, which De Bono and other people talk about, such as holding contrasting thoughts in your mind. Because you can, in fact, hold contrasting hypotheses quite well in your mind, it's very difficult to have anything more than a single percept at a single time.
Yes, sir.
Going back to those images of the test, does that indicate that this person, the last stage, was so all of reality like that?
Well, okay, that? Yeah. The question was that in the sequence with the cats, in the last stages, would that represent that the person was so out of touch with reality? In this case, I can only tell you what the biographer of Wayne said, and that is, he apparently Wayne would sort of fade in and out of lucidity, and Wayne claimed that he was painting the cats as he saw them. So that's all the data we have. We cannot, unfortunately, crawl inside of his brain and find out what he was actually perceiving.
Yes, sir.
Yes, Mr. Corn, I have a question about the perception of constellations. We're all viewed with modern astronomy and see only points of light out there.
Mm-hmm.
But people before modern astronomy apparently saw many things with great difficulty in seeing. Did they actually, generally, people see the constellations as they're pictured?
Well, that would sort of be like the horse and rider, which we showed you. Once somebody suggests the organization to you, you begin to see the organization. And in fact, the organization changes. For example, the Big Dipper is seen as a cart and wagon in some cultures. In some cultures, it's seen as a spade. In other cultures, it's seen as a great bear, and so forth, depending upon the assumptions that that culture has made.
Yeah.
I think some of this has been applied in particular traffic engineering is a practical basis where lines or arrows on the road, for instance, are much longer.
So there are many applications. For example, following the that radar screen which you saw, the FAA commissioned a study which caused the change of a number of these radar screens. The applications appear in a variety of different ways. In many instances, what we're dealing with here is a subject which deals with the way in which we interpret our information, regardless of what area or what discipline we're in. So for example, there were a number of early measurement errors having to do with the measuring microscopes because the lines were all wrong. They had those sort of same kind of grid type markings. And people were seeing things as being broken structures which were continuous or vice versa.
Gentleman over there.
I come back to the Zulu, the elephant, and the antelope.
Mm-hmm. No, it's not a matter of drawing in this case. It's a matter of perceiving. You see, he can recognize the objects. If you ask him, what is this? He'll say, a hunter. What is this? This is an antelope. What is this? It's an elephant. What he's not perceiving is the depth or the distance. The assumptions which we have are really quite strong. They show up in so many instances. Let's go back over here. Back. What do you see there? The man who asked the question? Family, where are they?
I see several people within a room.
Several people within a room. Okay. Now, this particular stimulus was used in the Ugandan countryside. And when people are asked what they see there, they see a family group, just as you do, sitting under a tree. And this woman has a 5-gallon can on her head, which is used to carry water. See, it is the presumption. It has to do with the hypotheses, the assumptions which you have. One percept is just as good as another, depending upon what your hypotheses are.
I think this gentleman had a question. Yeah.
Please comment on the color of sound.
Yes, the color of sound is synesthesia. I don't think it has to do with the same thing because there are a number of studies which have been done on synesthesia, and there is some evidence which suggests that it has to do with the suggestions which have been given to the person who reports being a synesthetic, that's seeing the colors of sound. Auras, well, that's a different type of perception, and I'd like to stay away from that.
Gentleman in the back.
My courtroom experience? No, I would prefer not to. There are several cases in which, in fact, I have been called to testify on what the limits of and the likelihood that a normal observer would have seen certain things. They're complicated and they're all situation specific, and we could be here for hours. That's the sort of thing which you talk about over cocktails.
Lady there in the middle.
But what? He drew. He illustrated children's books. He was a marvelous. He was a marvelous, marvelous man. I will give you a little insight on him. I can't tell you what school he's from, okay? But he was left-handed, okay? And it is the case that he was always drawing adventure sort of stories with morals in it, which had bad cats and good cats, okay? And because he had been strongly punished when he was a child for being left-handed, all of the good cats, the heroic cats, were left-pawed and all of the bad cats were right-pawed.
Yes.
What kind of hypothesis could you
The important thing, and the thing, and the question was, if you can't believe what you are seeing, what can you believe? Okay? And the important thing here to recognize is that, generally speaking, our percepts are pretty good, but they're not as good as we tend to think they are. And when another person says that they see something completely different, and that their perceptions of a situation are completely different, it's not necessarily the case because that they're lying, and they may well be perceiving something just as well as you are. They can be seeing the old man, and you can be seeing the rat, and you can argue with each other from now till next Tuesday, but each percept is just as valid as the other. I hope not. There is an old saying which was given by Anaxagoras which went, there is nothing in the mind which was not before in the senses. And that's all we've got, is the data from our senses.
Well, I think that's a good point in which to bring this meeting to a close, and I would like to ask Dr. Just a moment. I'd like to ask Dr. Peter Sudfeld, the head of the Department of Psychology at UBC and the Honorary Secretary of the Vancouver Institute, to thank Professor Korn.
Well, I'd like to tell you about one last illusion. A few years ago, the Department of Psychology thought it was hiring somebody who had an excellent record as a laboratory scientist in the field of visual perception and also an excellent reputation as a teacher. And it turned out that we had hired that person. Among other things, he has published more articles in less time than any other psychologist in Canada, and is a very popular teacher indeed. But aside from that, we seem to have hired about 10 other people, some of whom do things like research on the eye-hand coordination of Olympic athletes, the psychological implications of artworks from prehistoric cave drawings to the present, the reasons why the Aztecs built temples the way they did. Aside from that, he also plays tournament chess and builds paper airplanes and cooks marvelous Mexican food and so on. The illusion is that they all look and sound exactly like Stan Koren. And we haven't figured that one out yet. I think it's something to do with our hypotheses. At any rate, I'm glad that all of them are in the department, and I'm sure all of us are glad that one of them was able to come today.
I'd like to remind you that about the special lecture this Thursday at 7 o'clock by the Dalai Lama. The doors will open at 6:15. And next Saturday we have Dr. Charles Scriver from McGill speaking on you and the new genetics.